Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart for a year, and what a year it has been. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Make Woke AF Daily your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like a million bucks.
...scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes...
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old rich man, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On the Bechdel cast, the questions asked if movies have women in them. Are all their discussions just boyfriends and husbands, or do they have individualism? The patriarchy's effing vast. Start changing it with the Bechdel cast.
Oh, I wish I... Pretend I'm opening a can of Mike's Hard. Sk. Hello and welcome to the Bechdel cast retro version. My name's Jamie
throwback.
Loftus. Yes. I haven't drank Mike's during a Bechdelcast episode in literally a year and a half.
So long.
It's been a while, but I had two cold brews this morning, and so I'm like a young Judy Garland. I'm just upping and downing all damn day, and I'm going to die before I'm 50. I think that all tracks.
That works for me.
How are you, Caitlin?
I mean, I don't want you to die ever.
Thank you.
So please stay alive.
I think that the world, I forget
forever.
What that article said. I think the world's going to die when I'm like 47.
The world will die before we do, yes.
Yeah, so that's great.
Anyway, hi, I'm Caitlin Durante.
This is the Bechdelcast. This is our podcast about women in movies.
Mm-hmm. And we use the Bechdel test to initiate a larger conversation. I think most of the things we just said passed. You did say Mike's Hard Lemonade, so Mike.
Mm. We don't know how Mike... identifies.
That's true.
I honestly don't even know if Mike is a person or an idea.
Wow, makes you think.
Yeah, it's 2019, Caitlin.
That's right.
Yeah.
And also, how does the planet Earth identify? Genderless icon.
True.
That's what I say. Anyway, so the Bechdel test requires that a movie, for example, has two named female identifying characters who must speak to each other about something other than a man. And our version is just a two-line exchange. That's all that needs to happen.
Yes.
And, some movies do it and some movies don't.
Let's try it.
Okay.
Okay, here we go. Here's a Bechdel test. Mm. Hey, Caitlin.
Hey, Jamie.
You know what I love when it happens in a movie?
Tell me.
When New York is not just a place, but a character.
How does New York identify?
Oh my God, as a fucking asshole. I don't know. I just love when New York is, that's my favorite piece of film criticism, when they're like, the location is actually also a character, I love that. I think it's just a gorgeous, very thoughtful, original.
Definitely.
Way to describe something.
And it's what's crazy about this is that New York City, because it's a character, is my best friend.
Wow.
Yeah, I love them.
It. Well, that passed. We did it.
Yeah.
We did it. Doesn't have to be a good exchange. That's always the lesson. I'm so psyched for today's episode. It's been a request we've gotten quite a few times.
Oh, has it? Okay, good.
Yes, we have gotten this request quite a few times, and I'm so thrilled to have our guest on today.
Oh, my goodness.
One of my BFFs, honestly.
Yes, indeed. Yes. What a delight she is. She's an art critic. She's a comedian. She's got a book coming out called Aesthetical Relations. It's Christina Catherine Martinez.
Hello. Can I talk now?
You may speak. You may remove. We have gagged you.
I'm so excited.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here.
And today we are talking about I guess it's kind of hard to tell when this movie came out. People say between 2012 and 2013.
It was 2012.
Okay. It was released, you know what? Case closed. We're talking about Frances Ha.
Yeah.
Today. The way I think most people met Gertie Gerwig. Mm-hmm. You know, ever heard of her?
It does Gigi. Have a, it is confusing. It does have a lot of early aughts vibes to mm-hmm. it for yes. having come out in 2012.
And I think this movie, to me, I like this movie came out while I was in college. So, and this is people in college bait mm-hmm. Because it comes out in 2012. But honey, it's in black and white.
Yeah.
So you're like, so I go into this movie and I'm ready to think real hard.
Sure.
But yeah, it's a black and white 2012 movie directed by Noah Baumbach and written by him and Greta Gerwig, yeah. who I think by the time this movie comes out are an item, which they are to this day.
Good for them.
Yeah. He left. Who did he leave for Greta
Jennifer
Gerwig?
Jason Lee.
Really?
Yeah.
Did she have his baby? No, that was Tom Brady left, his pregnant.
Oh, God.
Bridget Moynihan, I think she was pregnant with
Oh, for Giselle?
His, yeah.
Oh, my
well,
goodness.
I mean, he's a Trump supporter, so we don't know. We simply can't with Tom Brady. Difficult. Difficult.
Yeah.
I wish it made me mad, though, like, oh, of course he left his wife for a younger lady, but I'm like, they work really well together.
Yeah, and it's just, I mean, two very cool women that he's been in at least a public relationship.
Oh, that Noah has. Okay.
That Noah, sure no, we're not
Tom still.
Let's just promise to never talk about Tom Brady again.
Okay, good.
No, but I don't know. Noah Baumbach, you know, think what you want about him. He's dated some cool ladies.
Sure.
But yeah, this is, I feel like, does this movie qualify as mumblecore? I feel like it's adjacent to it, but not. There's more plot to it than mumblecore.
I
and that's
suppose,
not saying that
although
much,
there's
but.
Not all that much plot. I would call this, oh, you know what we haven't said in a while? This is really a tone poem.
Oh.
That goes all the way back to our Josh Fadem episode. Yes, it really is a tone poem.
I would call
and
it,
there is a lot of horny depth to it, I would
say.
And
it's an actor's film.
It is
I
an
would
actor's
say.
Film. Wow.
It's
yeah.
mumble adjacent. I haven't, because mm-hmm. Greta Gerwig's character is pretty charming and quirky, but I have seen a clip of her acting in an actual mumblecore movie. And she's literally in a bathtub with goggles, you know, spouting to her friend, like, why, you know, can we connect? It's mumblecore is starting five sentences and not finishing any of them.
Sure.
Right. And this mumblecore, I mean, I had quite a bit of contempt for that genre. And I feel like everyone has dated a douchebag who is too into mumblecore. I'm like, my college boyfriend was like, you haven't seen the puffy chair? Like,
the puffy chair?
The puffy chair.
I guess I don't know what really classifies as mumblecore.
It's literally just about like,
it's like Italian neorealism, but bad.
It's like, it's usually about people in Brooklyn, usually a white hetero couple in Brooklyn, or brothers, mm-hmm. or like brothers working through their issues together. It's always really long. It's semi-scripted. It's, am I, what else is there?
I think it's, yeah, plotless, semi-scripted. And I think in an effort to come off as naturalized, I think the dialogue tends to be overly awkward. You know, like give
yeah.
people some credit. People are articulate in real life at some points.
Right.
Okay. I'm looking at a list. I don't recognize a lot of these movies. Oh, Jeff Who Lives at Home. I've seen that. I've seen Drinking Buddies. These are on this list.
Those are, mm-hmm. yeah. And I feel like
Coffee Chair.
Frances Ha and the two movies you just mentioned are on the more scripted side of that genre. Because mm-hmm. like early, like Greta Gerwig got her start in mumblecore movies. Mm-hmm. And most of her early stuff and most early mumblecore in general is, I feel, completely unwatchable and annoying.
Oh, Before Sunset is on this list.
I don't think that's...
That doesn't count.
Who made
count.
This Wikipedia page?
I know.
That, Before Sunset to me is like the opposite. It's so stylized because their dialogue is so pithy and
I love
clever.
Before Sunrise
I hate
Before
it,
Sunset.
But I still wouldn't call it mumblecore.
Sure.
But I think Frances Ha, I think, is maybe one of the more polished, if you could even call it of this genre. I wasn't really sure.
I don't think so. I think it's her graduation from mumblecore. She's, you know, collaborating with I was going to say real filmmaker. That's a horrible way to put it. You know, like, because he's a man. A real filmmaker.
He's a real filmmaker.
Wow. I didn't know that you were an MRA.
Yeah. I didn't. Oh, wow. I'm an enemy to my own sex. I will just maybe say off the bat, I like this movie.
Mm-hmm. did too.
Oh yeah. So what's your history, your relationship with this movie?
I think I saw it in the theater and I thought it was amazing. Mm. And I've been subject to a lot of movies with like a manic pixie dream character kind of thing. So I was ready to like totally hate it. But because I think it was a little more subtle than I was expecting, I freaking loved it.
Sure.
And then I watched it again this week, years later. Maybe liked it slightly less. There was a few cringy moments of like, here's a sincerity egg pie in your face. But but I really, it's charming. It's, you know, it's a coming of age story. But also I think the main thing, which is why it's fun to talk about on this podcast, is the romance is between like, is a female friendship.
Two girls.
Yeah.
And so I think it, a lot, even the more stylized moments, like if they had these montages of like playing and eating, and if they had that with a straight white couple, it would be so barferific.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there is something kind of sweet that it's just two friends, and sure, you don't really see that kind of intimacy too much in films.
Well, that's because movies don't like to have women in them.
No.
So.
Or only in certain ways. I did like, my history with this movie is I saw it, it came out when I was in college, and I went to a film school, and everyone was,
wow, Brad.
Like, I mean,
pause.
It really.
But did you go to
really
film school twice, though, Jamie?
No, I did. I wasn't quite that financially reckless.
Yeah, I was. Yes. I was then. I did go to film school twice.
Anyway. It's not movie school. It's film school.
I actually go a step further and I call it cinema school.
I like cinema school. Alliteration.
I go a step further. Really? I just say it in French. I went to an l'école de cinéma.
Wow. Oh my God. It's like, and it sounds like there's less debt involved when you say it that way. Mm-hmm. Point of that being that everyone I knew at this time saw this movie, loved this movie. And I was like, I don't know, I was like kind of an edgelord about it. And I remember watching it and being like, it's dumb. She's dumb. Like, I didn't like it when I first saw it. I think because I had it in my head. I was like, oh, these are mumblecore people. I don't like it very much. Even though I like The Squid and the Whale, but whatever. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and I just didn't take it very seriously. And I genuinely didn't understand most of the characters' motivations. And then I rewatched it this week with friend of the cast, Melissa Lozada Oliva, and we both hadn't seen it since college. We're the same age, and this time we're pretty much the same age as the protagonist of the movie, and it made a lot more sense to me this time. Mm-hmm. The whole vibe of, like, I feel insecure and, like, lesser than to my friends. I'm just going to put a reckless vacation on a credit card because I'm feeling uncomfortable with myself makes a lot more sense to me than it did when I was 19.
Sure.
And I got more out of it this time. I thought it has its things, and there are like definitely cringy moments, but I feel like I get it now.
All right.
What's your history with this movie?
I saw it probably sometime around, I think I was in Boston still when I watched half of it.
It's when we were ships in the night.
It popped up on Netflix at some point, and I think it probably never left.
It's been on Netflix for 900 years, yeah.
So I think I maybe saw it in like 2013, watched the first half of it, and it's not that I wasn't enjoying myself, but I wasn't like super fully engaged, and then got sidetracked and then never felt compelled to finish it.
Sure.
So I had only seen half of this movie before prepping for the episode. And I guess I wasn't very compelled by it because I've said it before, I'll say it again. I love a good romp. I would not call this movie
it's not quite a romp.
There's not like a shaggy dog story, but just sort of like a shaggy teacup poodle. Also, it's on Netflix because I paid to watch this on Amazon Prime.
Christina, no. It's been on Netflix for 6 years.
Do you guys have an expense account? Is there like a, who do we talk to
we'll
about getting that?
Venmo you $10.
It's $3.99.
Oh, okay. No, actually, that's unacceptable. I think that people would be like, wow, this is the first time anyone's rented this movie in 5 years.
It like kicked up some server in Iowa that like,
this hasn't made a move in years.
Can I give you a tip and all of our listeners a tip?
Mm-hmm.
There is an app called Just Watch.
Ooh, I don't know about this.
Okay.
This is not an ad, by the way.
This is not an ad. We are not sponsored by Just Watch.
No.
But if
we're
sponsored
by Smart Food Popcorn.
Yes.
Honey.
If you download this app called Just Watch and type in the name of any movie or TV show or anything like that, mm-hmm. it will tell you what platforms it is streaming for free on. It'll tell you where you can rent it, and it tells you where you can buy it.
That's amazing. I feel like IMDb should be doing that.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm.
There's a few movies you can watch for free on IMDb. You can watch Paddington 1 on IMDb for free.
Yeah.
I think they're going to become the new Amazon. They're going to start...
Let's see. Capitalism is all around us, and there.
So if you can get anything for free,
do it now. Yeah.
Touch ID to install.
Yes.
Take my fingerprint, Lord Bezos.
Everyone pause, and yes, please take my identity.
Anyway. Identify me, Lord Bezos.
Should we go into the recap?
Yeah.
Go from there.
Which is difficult because there's kind of no plot. I was trying to figure this out.
You're not wrong.
The one thing I was surprised at that I totally forgot about from my first watch of this movie is Adam Driver Fedora. It is weird now to watch early Adam Driver knowing he is now an animatronic at Disney World and be like, a mere 6 or 7 years ago, he was Fedora guy in a Noah Baumbach movie.
Mm-hmm.
A man we were introduced to coming on Lena Dunham is now an animatronic. Truly a marvel.
Also, did you notice that the other roommate is the husband, the crappy husband from Marvelous Mrs. Maisel?
No.
I haven't watched that show yet.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I just outed myself as a watcher of that show. Thank you, Lord Bezos.
Christina is sponsored by Jeff Bezos. She's actually a bot that he made.
Incredible.
Alexa is actually based on Christina.
Yeah, it's just my brain. It's just there's a little Alexa in there.
Talk about the ultimate manic pixie dream girl, Alexa.
Girl.
She's,
yeah.
There was a movie about
Alexa. Validate me artistically.
There. what happens in the movie, Caitlin? Because not really anything.
I'll do my best. So, Francis is a young woman living in New York City. Ever heard of it? And her roommate and best friend is Sophie. Shout out to our super producer, Sophie, who shares the same name.
Who's played by Mickey Sumner, who I was not familiar with.
And Frances is, of course, Greta Gerwig. Greta
Gerberg.
Who co-wrote the movie. Frances's boyfriend, Dan, asks her to move in with him, but she would rather continue living with Sophie and just do everything with Sophie, really. So this causes her and Dan to break up.
In a scene that I watched twice because I was like, are they really? Are they break? What? Where he was just like, well, then maybe we shouldn't be together anymore. I was like, geez, all right, fine.
He's also talking about wanting to get cats, two cats for the both of them.
Expensive
to have together.
Cats, to be fair.
Right.
But that's a very real point in a relationship that maybe, as a young 19-year-old, you could not relate to.
Yes.
But, especially when you're late 20s, I think this character's 27, which is maybe still too early for this talk. It's kind of like, if we're not going to move in together, then what's the point of keeping going?
Yeah.
As someone who splits custody with a dog.
I've had that breakup, we're not going to get married, so
why are we here?
Why are we here? How much longer will this happen?
If we're not going to share cats together, then what's the fucking point?
Yeah, the cats are a metaphor.
Cats do have 8 nipples. This is Cat Facts with Caitlin.
Yeah. She didn't seem too broken up about the breakup, though.
No, it seems like one of the interesting scenes that I enjoyed of, it was like a weird... Like, whose idea was it to break up? They sort of just mutually were like, well...
I like that.
She's
kind of like... He says this isn't working, meaning the discussion of them talking about moving in together. And she interprets that as like, our relationship isn't working. And then he's like, okay, I guess we're going to break up then, if that's how you feel about it.
And then she thinks about it for a second. She's like, yeah, that's fine. Yeah. And then later Sophie is like, Greta Gerwig's character... Frances. I'm going to keep calling her Greta Gerwig. Mm. Greta Gerwig is like, I only broke up with Dan because I thought we were going to keep living together. And Sophie kind of immediately is like, that's not the only reason, though. And Greta's like, no, I guess not.
Right.
So she wanted to break up with
him. I want to get into this later, but Frances's codependent behaviors will just...
Oh, they are...
present.
Legion.
And that's the first scene where we see her apologize 100 times, which is a type of visibility. I feel like this is one of the good, like, mumblecore-y elements, is she apologizes, like, 7 times for no reason in that scene, which you don't get to see female characters do a lot, even though that's something that, like, we're hardwired to do.
For passing the Bechdel test, she does say, "I feel bad," all the time in the movie.
Yeah. Which is, like, I mean, there's different, like, I feel like there's a big pressure on female characters to set an example. And it's kind of, like, nice and refreshing to see a character who's just kind of reflecting a certain type of woman at a moment in time. And
sure.
I liked, I mean, the constant apologizing can relate.
Yeah.
Yes.
So she and Dan have broken up. And then one day, Frances and Sophie are on the train together, I think. And Sophie is like, "I want to move in with my friend Lisa in this great apartment that we found in Tribeca. Hey, Frances, are you okay with that?" And Frances is clearly not okay with that. But she's like, "Yeah, I'm okay with that." And then, so this is the beginning of their friendship crumbling. So now that...
For now.
So now that Frances is single, she goes on a date with this guy, Lev. That's Adam Driver's character. This doesn't go anywhere romantically, but she does move in with him and his friend Benji, just, like, sleeping on their couch.
Who is, and Benji is
Benji's
the
Joel from Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
Right.
Got it. I'm sure a lot of our listeners will know. We just haven't seen it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cute as a button.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't care.
She's moved in with them. She has not seen that much of Sophie recently. And then Sophie finally does come over to Frances's new place, but she's, like, all judgy. She doesn't stay very long. She's got this boyfriend, Patch, that she, like, hangs out with a lot now. And Frances is having some money struggles. She's in this dance company because she does ballet. Or she's an understudy, I guess, in the dance company. And she's thinking that they'll be able to use her in this Christmas show, and that will make her, that will earn her more money, but they're not able to use her after all.
Mm-hmm. So she's proud of herself for asking. That's another moment of hers that I really liked.
Yeah. So she doesn't have this money that she thought was coming in, and then she and Sophie get in this big fight, and Sophie seems to be withdrawing from their friendship more and more. Meanwhile, the roommate Benji keeps calling Frances totally undateable.
Which is, like, one of the eye-rolly elements of
this
movie.
Yeah, that was what it stuck out as, like, a little...
Yeah, we can have that. We can talk about that.
That was, like, one of the few I was like, this didn't age well. This isn't as cute as they thought it was.
And then Frances can't afford to stay with Lev and Benji anymore, so she goes to stay with her friend Rachel from the dance company, who clearly does not seem to really like Frances.
Who's a Kazan, I believe.
Oh, or a Kazan.
A Kazan. Sorry, I'm not French.
So is this what we say in the art world?
Kazan.
A Kazan.
Sorry, Christina is our representative from the art world. And so if we're fucking it up, let us know.
We just put the emphasis on a different syllable.
Oh, we're okay. Pedestrian heathens.
I'm sorry, you meant a... Pedestrian
heathen.
Pedestron. Pedestron.
The hoi polloi.
So she is hanging out with Rachel and Rachel's friends, and she finds out from these people that Sophie and her boyfriend Patch are moving to Japan in a few weeks. And Sophie hasn't told this directly to Frances, so she's like, oh no.
Some of these problems are so Brooklyn that you're just like, sure, my boyfriend and I are moving to Japan in a few weeks. I'm sorry, Frances. You're just like, sure.
I do take this movie as, like, Brooklyn gospel. Maybe that's totally misguided, but... I'm like, oh, I feel like that happens all the time, that you would go on a date with someone. If it doesn't work out, you can just become roommates.
You just move in with them.
Yeah.
I think so. So then Frances decides to spontaneously go to Paris, and it's basically a wasted trip because she, like, sleeps the whole time accidentally and doesn't do anything.
That's the part where Melissa and I started crying.
This is actually we could go in it. I think this is the best part of the movie. This is when it's actually kind of subverting its own romanticism and showing how locked up this character is.
Let's talk about that. Okay. Let's put a pin in that. And then
Really quick, I meant Rachel. I confused my Kazans and my Gummers. Grace Gummer plays Rachel, aka Meryl Streep's daughter.
What is a Gummer?
Oh,
A Meryl Streep's daughter is what it is.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, Meryl Streep or Meryl Streep?
Meryl Streep. Welcome and take a left onto Meryl Streep. Big Little Lies season 2 might be over by the time this episode
comes out. We call her Meryl Streep.
Hey, France.
Okay, so she's in Paris and then...
Very French.
Sophie calls her to finally tell her that she's moving to Japan. Their conversation is very tense. And then she gets back to the U.S. She has a meeting with a dance company owner, and she thinks she's going to be made a part of the touring company, but instead she is offered an office job, which she turns down immediately.
Also a devastating, I don't know, that scene was also like...
Oh. Devastating, but I also like that because she was like, no, I don't want that job. I know what I want, and I'm going to immediately say no.
She turns it down, yeah. But that was a tough scene to watch her, like, process what was happening.
Yeah. Because she had, like, already started telling people. She's like, I'm going to be touring soon. Yeah. And then she's like,
God. As someone who has jumped the gun in
that
before.
Even then, it was even sadder because her saying touring company was playing down her own expectations. Like, oh, I'm definitely going to join the company, but probably just a touring company.
Right. And then she doesn't even get that. Poor Frances.
I think Greta Gerwig's really good in this movie. The way she, like, Anyways.
So then we cut to Frances having moved to Poughkeepsie to be an RA at the college where she went to school. And she works.
It's supposed to be Vassar, I think.
Is it?
That's what I saw. Okay. And that's what the Wikipedia said.
Got it. Okay.
All colleges east of the Mississippi kind of blend together for me.
Yeah. it's very like neo-lib femme. You're like, oh, this is a female-friendly space. She returns to Vassar, her alma mater. Is that how you say it?
Oma, mater.
Oma, mater.
Well, we have fun. So she's at this school in Poughkeepsie, aka Vassar. She is working various events around campus to make money. And at one of them, Sophie and Patch are in attendance.
Patch.
And like Frances is lurking around until she overhears Sophie say that she and Patch are engaged. And she's like, what? You're engaged?
Right, because she's lurking around because she's a caterer and she doesn't want to be exposed as working as a caterer.
Mm-hmm. But then like, record scratch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whoa, what? That really is how that scene plays out.
She actually does a triple take with a neon sunglasses. And just the sunglasses are in color.
Yeah. It's kind of like Schindler's List in that way. Go on.
Yes. So she and Sophie get to talking at this event. Sophie is drunk. She and Patch are not getting along. And then later that night, Sophie shows up to Frances's dorm room and they kind of rekindle their friendship a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then Sophie says that she wants to leave Tokyo. She wants to leave Patch. She wants to move back to New York.
So Brooklyn.
Yes.
So Sex in the City.
I think I'm going to leave
you
Patch.
You are New York.
I think I'm going to leave Patch because I just figured out New York is a character in the movie.
Yeah. And I want to leave Patch, but I don't want to leave my friend character New York.
I couldn't help but wonder, was New York my boyfriend?
That sounds like a Carrie Bradshaw voiceover.
That's exactly what I was trying to
do. Good. Nailed it. And then sometime later, Frances has moved back to New York City. She is choreographing dances. She puts on a show. All of her friends are there, including Sophie and Patch, who have gotten married. Her old roommates, Lev and Benji, are there. The dance company instructor, owner, person is there. And then that's when I stopped writing down my version of the recap. And then I don't know if anything happens after that.
Well,
so if there's any blanks to fill in,
the only thing that I also thought was a little, I thought it was a really lovely ending in terms of, you know, it was because it's a movie about like an artist finding themselves, but also within the limits of her own artistic capacity, which is like her coming to grips with that she's not going to be the great dancer that she wants to be, but she's actually has a voice as a choreographer, and it's this adjacent thing which feels like a compromise, and it's why she resists it. But then, you know, there's something. Then the end is the only time you actually see, you know, a piece of her work.
Sure.
So it kind of celebrates that, and I think that's sweet.
Nice. And then the storyline about her and her friendship with Sophie ends is that they like are I think they're on the subway again and they're talking about like, oh, what if we got apartments like really close to each other?
She lives alone, but they live alone.
They live alone. Yeah.
It seems like I thought the ending was lovely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What I remember, there's a little bit of a shoehorning of a romantic element in that her and Benji connect again, and he's like, I'm single. And she's like, oh, me too. And you're like, I guess we're undateable. And then it's implied that they're going to get together. But the ending is a moment that Francis refers to during the dinner party, you know, half an hour earlier about, you know, what she wants out of a relationship. And she's like, talks about, this was a little cringy and hard to watch, but it's true, and it made me very uncomfortable to watch it. Mm-hmm. She's like, you know, talking about, like, you know, when that feeling, like when you're at a party and like you and your person are both being charming and amazing, and then you just catch each other's eye,
you look
and
up,
and you share a moment, and it's just you and your person having your own little world, blah blah blah.
Yeah,
and it's cute callback because she has that moment with Sophie, and that's the end of the movie.
Okay, got it.
Yeah,
awesome.
It's I liked. I mean. In retro, I feel like this movie, I don't know. I'm like, even 7 years later, I wonder if like the Benji of it all would have gotten the attention that it does at the end. Mm-hmm. But it stays pretty well within the bounds of like the friendship is where the emphasis is, which feels like where it belongs.
Yeah. And we can talk more about that right after this break.
Right after the break.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent, telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout. And woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, so a few things right at the jump. Mm. I mean, this also takes place in an all-white New York City.
Oh, yes.
Like many movies.
Like New York is, like, clearly. If cinema is not the true reflection of reality.
He's like, hold on a second. Which is, I think, like one of the more glaring like things about it. This movie, like, there are class elements addressed in it that I thought were kind of cool, and where it's, I feel like this movie brings up something that not a lot of movies or really people do, which is like kind of like what the difference between being broke and being poor is. And this movie calls that out pretty directly, mm-hmm. where like Frances Ha is broke but not poor,
sure,
per se, where like she's a struggling artist, but we see, you know, in Sacramento, aka Greta Gerwig canon, she has a loving family who it, we think that, you know, and they're like, oh, we're sorry, we can't help you out more. Mm-hmm. But like, worst case,
she's got a support system.
Yeah. Worst case, she could move home. And right. I think that that's like a cool thing to see reflected. Yeah.
Also the fact that she's the most broke of her friend group. But the fact that, I mean, it even speaks to her, I guess, like talent or drive. That I'm like, wait a minute, you're a full-time dancer? Right. You know, with no day job in New York City, and you have a roof over your head, that's amazing.
It's a miracle, yeah.
And Benji, his maybe only his true function is to call her out on that. She talks about being poor, and he's like, you are not poor. He's like, there are poor people in New York, and you are not one of them. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, and like that scene, it was like kind of a relief to see that addressed. Because it's like, I don't know, I've been the brokest of my, but there's a difference. Yes. There's definitely a difference of having no alternative.
Yeah.
And like what we're seeing in her with her is like she's definitely struggling, but it's more of an like it's worst case she could pony up and take the office job. You know, like
exactly.
So, I also see I'm ambivalent about the people who sort of refuse to get day jobs because like I'm an artist and this is, I mean, there's something that I want to say is admirable about that, but it's also a privilege just to be.
Oh, yeah. You can only do
I simply can't do anything else.
It's right.
People who, and we know plenty of them here in, you know, L.A., for example.
A barista, what on earth is that?
But, I mean, the people who are able to do that come from a place of privilege.
Yeah, and people who have a support network can actually deal with a lot more scarcity day to day, just knowing that it's there, it's a psychological thing.
Yeah, like having the option of, I mean, like I've like always been kind of scant, but like worst case, I could go back to Brockton, Massachusetts and live in my pappy's house, you know, like that sort of thing, which is like a sort of privilege that is not checked in movies very often.
Mm-mm. Definitely.
In pappy's shack.
Literally in pappy's crumbling home.
Sorry, it's a pappy's shack.
Anyone who's ever been to my pappy's crumbling home.
Pappy's chateau. Jamie's safe space.
Every time I go home, my father gently takes out his teeth and says, it's always an option.
To have no teeth?
No, to move back into his crumbling shack. All that to say, it is an option, and I am fortunate to have it.
Certainly.
And it is kind of like, I felt checked in that way, too, and I was like, yes, like that is not something that is called out on very often.
Sure.
Which is good.
This is, I think, pretty standard for this genre, but so many movies that, you know, take place in New York and are about artists or otherwise feature people who appear to be so abundantly wealthy that you're just confused about how do you afford this apartment? And so, yeah, the fact that it's even her, you know, struggling financial situation is called attention to.
I mean, the through line of the plot is just, her real estate struggles, because I think the plot is separated by the different locations that she has to live.
Yeah.
And it's like, address, next act. You know what I mean?
Right.
The money aspects of this movie I thought were, like, more realistic than most things you would see, because that one of the scenes that, like, hit for me, I think when I first saw it, even more so than now, was her having to remind her wealthier roommates, like,
that she needs to pay.
that she's paying less and that they agreed to that. Because I think that was maybe the only thing I related with this movie the first time around, was like it's implied that Adam Driver and the guy from Marvelous Mrs. Maisel are like two kind of trust fund babies who don't have much to worry about. And they're artists too, so they're peers, but they're not really class wise because she's from kind of like a middle class family
who
support her but can't support her.
Right.
And so she has to remind them from the couch that she's only paying $9.50 and that they said that was okay, right? And then it's like this awkward interaction.
And the guy's like, oh yeah, I forgot. Okay. So I'm like, wow, who has like an extra $300 a month?
I just know,
be like, it's chill.
Right. Which I mean, Adam Driver, I like him. I like him.
Are you trying to convince yourself still?
No, I don't want to like him. I want because his career trajectory is fucking baffling.
He was in the army. He puts on operas for the army.
Adam Driver's so like I'm like, is he like a testament to male mediocrity? And if so, why do I like him? Like he. It's just weird, but whatever. I like him, and I think he does a good job in this movie.
I think he's on track to be our nation's next Keanu.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, where it's like, well, I think he's like Keanu in that, and I'm like, I don't know if he's good, but I never hate to see him.
Yeah, he's so compelling, and for being sort of a big star, there's actually something still kind of enigmatic about him.
He's an Oscar-nominated like that, I'm just like, we've gone too far. Maybe he shouldn't have been nominated for an Oscar.
What was he nominated for?
He was nominated for Black Klansman.
I didn't know. Right. Adam Driver?
Yeah.
Yes. I didn't even know he was in Black Klansman.
Yeah. Okay. He sure is.
You hate to see it, but he is.
There's a moment, I think it's at the end of the date, the one date that Lev, Adam Driver's character, and Francis go on. He basically tries to give her not a surprise kiss, but it's like a surprise touch on her shoulder. And she just goes, ee! And then like tightens up.
Which is like one of the many moments in this movie where you're like, that was a little too manic pixie dream girl in the execution, but I appreciate what you were doing.
It was exaggerated, but I have, you know, pulled that move.
Sure.
And I'm not trying to say that like the artistic merit of this movie is completely predicated on me relating to it, but I have, listen, okay. Like, I'm a cancer survivor, but like nothing really prepares you for being diagnosed as quirky. And I think that's something that every woman in this room has struggled with.
Yes, you know, we're all recovering.
I mean,
it's difficult.
We're all recovering adorkables.
We're all recovering not like the other girls.
It's funny because I felt like that was a good, it was maybe exaggerated, but I thought that was a really real moment in that I feel like most encounters, if they are consensual, but you're not on the same page, they're not very articulate where it's like, may I touch you here? And then it's like, yes, it's usually someone having to sense through body language that this is not okay. And sometimes that can like erupt in awkward ways.
Well, what we always see, I don't even mind her reaction.
Yeah.
And I would like to get into the kind of like, you know, manic pixie discussion of this. But what I enjoy is that we see so much in movies, a, you know, surprise kiss or surprise touch, which is framed as being this like wonderfully romantic moment that happens even though only one party is privy to what's about to happen and no one has given consent. But
and it's made to look like a gesture and not a,
right, not a, like, you know, borderline sexual assault kind of thing. Yeah, so I like that she gives like a reaction because, you know, she didn't consent and she reacts appropriately.
I think that whole scene with their date, though, I enjoyed in general because I like he is a master at being as acting like a Brooklyn douchebag and is playing that part masterfully in this scene, and it like made me laugh at a lot of different points because he's playing this douchebag that she's like kind of visibly not impressed by,
right?
Where there's that whole thing where he, you know, he's showing her stuff on his phone. It's so cringy. He's like, yeah, this is me. I went to a basketball game once. You like basketball, right? And she's like, oh, I went to a game once. And he's like, yeah, anyways, motorcycle. Yeah, anyways, this is me and Jay Leno, which I love.
And then she goes back to his apartment. I love the way the male characters are kind of flattened. But they're like kids, like showing her their toys. Like when they go back to the apartment, Benji's always showing her, like, look at these things I got. Look at my old camera. It's so
It's showing like traditional flirting tactics that I think in a different movie would be made out to seem like really cute or cool. And it like makes him look kind of pathetic in this context. Like, and it's kind of nice to see like a Brooklyn trust fund boy look pathetic because they very often are. Or like when she insists on paying for dinner for their date. date.
Yes.
And it is very funny because it's like that's another way that her brokenness comes into play because her card gets rejected. She has to like go pay a $3 fee at an ATM, which is a triggering experience mm-hmm. we've all had. But then he like is also a dick about that in a way where he's like, you know, I'm not going to sleep with you, right? And she's like, what? And he's like, oh, I'm just pretending to be a liberated woman.
Right.
And she's like,
yeah, you are.
And she's like, ha ha, okay. Like, I don't know. The way that date scene played out, I thought was like, at least, I mean, and I guess that's kind of the point of movies like this. Like, in a movie where the female character is there to set an example for other women, she would be like, you're full of shit. But in a movie that I think that it's reflecting an awkward situation that has happened to a lot of people, she's kind of just like, whatever, like, and trying to get through it, which is cool to see, too.
It is. In terms of, I mean, movies, I mean, even not having a style is a style, so it's like a... You have to, like, pick and choose when your character is going to have the, like, the articulate breakthrough, and that's, like, that wasn't the moment for it. Because it's not about her relationship with men. It's about her relationship with her friends. So that's why her big articulate moment is at this dinner party talking about a hypothetical relationship, and it turns out it's with her BFF.
Right. Yeah, can we talk more about that?
Yeah, let's talk about it.
Oh.
In conclusion, Adam Driver is M'lady the character.
Monsieur, good job, my man. Anyway.
Has a motorcycle.
I think, yeah, they have kind of a weird, I just wrote down Francis's codependent behavior. It is definitely contrasted, obviously, in the first two scenes where she's like, I can't move in with you because I have to stay with my friend.
Oh, to
and
her
that
boyfriend?
Whole just,
yeah,
yes,
yeah.
Just the apologizing and the, I feel bad, I feel guilty. It's so, but her friend, and I know she's sort of maybe the Sophie character, I feel like is flattened to be a little more like not as artsy or weird, but she's definitely more self-possessed in that, you know, she has her own thing that she wants to do and is like checking in with Francis, but is like, I'm going to do this. I want to move out because...
Right.
My dream of living in this neighborhood, which is maybe longer than I've known you, is like important. So I'm checking in, but I'm telling you this is what I want.
Mm-hmm. And that's something that I didn't understand about the movie when I first saw it that I understand now of just like, I guess just like this friendship, as adorable as it is in the opening, but it's like they're 27 years old. They need boundaries. And that's something that I think that Sophie recognizes first.
Yep.
And so it's weird because I think when I first watched this movie, you sort of view her as like, oh, why is she hurting Francis's feelings? This sucks. But then it's just like, no, she just like, it's not that she's breaking off the friendship.
Yeah.
She just needs to change the boundaries of it. And that like makes sense for what we see in the opening sequence.
Yeah. First you just see her, she's the unsympathetic, non-artsy character. And there's a really low moment. I thought it was actually kind of mean where Francis is like, oh, Sophie's not smart. She doesn't even read. And I was like, so mean.
Right.
Also, she's at work, Francis.
A big thing is like, because the character, like Patch, like Sophie's kind of crappy boyfriend that's sort of in the background. The fact that Sophie's character just continues to stay with him. And it's not so flattened that it's like, he's horrible. It's just that Francis doesn't like him. And it's probably implied that he doesn't like him just because she takes up her time.
Yeah, right.
Right. I also didn't recognize on first watch.
The whole just that she recognizes what Francis doesn't like about her boyfriend and is just like, okay, noted. Like, I'm staying with this person. And there's a cute moment kind of where she's just finally like, I do like you. He's like, I like you too.
And it's like that complicated, like, Francis is not totally wrong about Patch, but she's saying it for the wrong reasons. Mm-hmm. She's expressing it for the wrong reasons. And that does play out where, like, Sophie and Patch don't end up together. Sophie ends up, like, a lot of, like, everyone's had a friend's significant other that you're not crazy about.
Wait, don't Sophie and Patch, they do end up together, didn't they?
They end up married, yeah.
Oh, wait.
She says she's going to leave
him. But then she doesn't.
But then and we cut to later, and they're like, yeah, we got married.
Which is funny because it makes me feel like that sort of behavior is something maybe like that comes up with Sophie just when they're together, that they like to have this, they do their like little New York fantasy thing when they're together. And then when they're apart, she's like, well, maybe I should just like be with this dude.
Yeah.
I thought it was like super cool to see not like a Mary Sue female friendship where like, and again, it's just like the kind of movie this is, where some movies you want to see a perfectly functioning female friendship, mm-hmm. like in Captain Marvel, that's what you want to see because it is a setting example of movie. This is more of like a mumblecore realist thing. Mm-hmm. And it's nice to see a friendship between women that is like complicated. There are different points in their head and in their life, and it's just like more of a reflection of, and as much as like there are some of the Mary Sue friendships that I really enjoy, but in a way I feel like it's a little bit limiting in that it just leads to the idea that all female friendships have to be perfect, which yeah. of course they're not.
I mean, it's a testament that even like, even if your feelings change about the movie, like we all, I think we all feel a little bit differently from the first time we saw it years ago to now.
Yeah.
That it's more nuanced. It's not like the friendship is horrible or toxic either. It's just, it's freaking,
they're, I mean,
freaking complicated.
They're, kind of, they're growing as people at different rates. Like you said, right. there's like, Sophie realizes that maybe they're too codependent first. She's the first one to realize this, or yeah. that she, like, they've just sort of entwined each other in their lives a bit too much, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. They've been character development wise developed enough that, you know, they've been given these nuances that we don't see enough.
It's cool. So. I mean, and just like in general of any gender, seeing a friendship that is like, yeah, like not completely black and white toxic, but just like these characters growing apart a little bit is something that happens to people all the time that I feel like is really hard to communicate on screen.
I feel like it's hard to dramatize like yeah. the natural, you know, widening of a friendship.
Or someone who's like feeling a little bit left behind, right. or the other person who's feeling a little frustrated and being like, why don't you get it? Like,
I mean, this will happen to me sometimes just in my personal life where I have a friend that I just kind of don't want to be friends with anymore. And there's sorry, Jamie. I'm so sorry to tell you this, that I don't want to be your friend anymore.
Oh my God.
She told me it was you.
But I mean, you know, people grow apart or maybe their interests were never that similar to begin with, but you end up in a friendship with someone. But there's no etiquette for like breaking up with a friend,
yeah.
really, that hasn't been established in the world. So.
Or even like renegotiating the boundaries of a friendship.
Right.
It only takes one person to do that, though. I mean, however the other person reacts is.
That's true.
Sure.
Have you ever had to do something like that?
Yes.
I'm really bad
at it. I'm doing
it
with like five different people right now.
Well, what I end up doing is just basically what Sophie does is just to kind of withdraw and like avoid the person and like just not share as much with them. And then so I really feel bad for the people who are on the receiving end of this, which in this movie, Francis is.
Yeah.
Which is like,
and that's a sign but that's a sign of codependence as well, is that when someone else, not even saying that the Sophie character is doing it in exactly the perfect or sensitive way,
sure.
but that codependent people will react to other people's boundaries with offense and,
right.
you know, will be just reactionary and take everything personally.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's like, and it is, it was a little like, I've only successfully done this once or twice, but like when you do sort of like say like, this is my new boundary, like whatever. Mm-hmm. And then seeing like, you're like, I know I'm hurting this other person, but you never see it. But in Frances Ha, you see it. And
yeah.
you see her go on the sad vacation and you see her be like, like, it's just a lot of this movie, truly, like watching it with my friend, it was like tough to watch. But then after we stopped watching it and it was over, like we were talking about it for a full hour and I was just like, I feel bad after watching that. She's like, I think it's because we understand it now.
Yeah. It's hard to make the Sophie character sympathetic when it's like, I don't know, maybe she's the healthy one. I mean, obviously not. No one's perfect.
Right.
Quick shout out to Mickey Sumner. I don't know what she did after this movie. She's the actress who played Sophie, and she was so good.
She's really, really good. Yeah, I let me see it.
I don't know what she's done since, but I mean, I saw it.
She's an indie gal. She's been in a lot of indie movies.
Mm-hmm. It was even weirder. I watched it with my boyfriend, like, in bed, and I don't know why that was
hot.
No. And there's a part when she does her big thing about, like, you know, finding your person, mm-hmm. which is weird because
she's very Grey's Anatomy, isn't that?
Well, that's
where
what
that
we refer
from?
To, like, dogs, like, you know. When I talk about, like, my dog being too anxious or attached, he's like, oh, well, you're just her person. And I'm like, yeah, that's a thing for dogs, not for people.
It's true. Yeah, like this is, I don't know, this was like a way more effective coming of age story than I remembered it being.
And especially because it's for the second coming of age that people do, because most coming of age stories are around like teens, like, oh, I'm in
the high school.
And then
which is interesting, like, what she did later with like Lady Bird.
I think Melissa said at one point, she was like, oh, so like Lady Bird is like the prequel to Frances Ha. And Lady Bird eventually becomes Frances Ha because we've already seen her family in Sacramento. And she like started to galaxy brain it.
Oh, wow. There's a
conspiracy theory.
That's headcanon right there. Yeah. We got to take another quick break. But then, hey, guess what? We'll come right back.
Yeah. This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout, and woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Can we talk Frances Undateable really quick? Because that was like the one part of this movie other than like the... I mean,
it was the fly in my soup of the cinematic experience.
Yes. Like, it was... I didn't like the implied potential romance with what's-his-name?
Benji.
Like,
Benji.
I didn't like that, but it remained in the background enough of the movie that it wasn't, like, distracting. It certainly didn't ruin it for me.
Right.
But the whole, like, them trying to catchphrase, like...
Haven't you said this before, that, like, a character as, like, a living studio note? It feels like maybe that's, like, you know, someone at Pictures was, like...
well, there has to be some kind of, you know,
flirtation,
hetero love story in there.
I want to give Greta Gerwig the credit and say that I don't think that this was her idea.
Yeah.
Like, because the focus of the movie, for the most part, remains on Francis and Francis and Sophie's friendship.
Right.
And, like, Francis sort of having to accept that compromise is a part of life. But with the Benji stuff, yeah, like, it does sort of, he serves... The best part of him, I thought, was him pointing out that she's not as, like, extremely poor as she makes herself out to be. Mm-hmm. That was, like, a cool, valid use of him. But then, like, I didn't like the scenes where they're supposed to be flirting.
Well, because he's negging her.
And they
the
keep
time.
Running totally into negging. Each other yeah. in cute right. ways. And they're making it seem like, well, maybe. But
will
but
they, won't they?
He's so tiny. The time we see them together, he is totally negging her. And then there's that weird scene where they're talking and he's in their, oh, God. And it's like, I feel like a lot of people have had an experience like this that is just very uncomfortable where the guy's like, you know, everyone says we should date. And then you're like, oh, really? And he's like, yeah. But I was like, no, she's just cool. And like that whole scene, I mean, it made
we're bros, right?
That scene made me cringe because it's like, you know, I've had that experience. Yeah. But then the fact that they still kind of present him as romantically viable after you find out he's that kind of, like, weird guy just didn't feel great.
Right.
I just didn't like
that.
And
the fact that he's constantly negging her as what I think the movie frames as a flirtation technique for him. He's like, oh, well.
Yeah, just by implying that he's still on the table, I feel like that makes
it
seem like
he's just awkward. Let's try to reframe this as... artistic merit. So isn't it so like true to life though that like, you know, even though she finds her voice artistically, which in and of itself is a compromise of what she saw as her artistic
she still
path,
might end up with right. a loser.
She still might end up with like just some guy.
Right.
Just some like neggy, tiny little man.
Yeah. Ugh, God.
Who like kinda, you know, teases her and probably the more successful she gets as a choreographer, he's gonna like it's gonna be a little weirder and more resentful.
Yeah. Where I decided I was done with that character officially was when he was like, you should leave your door open. Like when that part when he at the end of the scene where he's been negging her the whole time, he's like, we should date, but no we shouldn't. Like that whole fucking look, God, I mean, truly, coming from I have here's my deepest shame. I have dated a Brooklyn Trust Fund boy. His
wow.
father used to be the president of something called
Enron.
No, it was like called the Patriotic Millionaires. It was really bad.
Whoa.
It was a very troubling 7 weeks of my life. Mm. Anyways, like most trust fund boys in Brooklyn, he very abruptly married a graphic designer.
Okay. You go to the
Is
store.
Is that triggering for anyone?
You go to the wing. They put them all in the window.
Uh-huh.
You go to the wing. All the graphic designers are just kind of lined up in a window like puppies. They have a little cut-up newspaper for them to play around in.
Sure.
And he's like, you pass by and you're like, that one.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There she is. So anyways, wish him the best, whatever. But like that whole vibe being presented as like, maybe this will work out. I'm just like, no, this shouldn't. Even for like a realist movie, please, let's just like, let's spare Francis Ha the potential
What's
of
funny,
this douchebag.
I felt a little bit the opposite in that moment that after he was a dick, the one, even though it was didn't come off court, right, the one nice thing he said was like, I'll leave it open in case you need anything. And I was like, oh, okay.
See, so. I hated that. She said closed, and then he convinced her to leave it open. Like because he was like, open or close. And she's like, oh, probably close. And he's like, well, but what if you
need me?
Right. And then she's like, okay,
yeah.
Open.
He's
like
okay,
that I was just
your,
like, oh, you fucking Brooklyn
here's your
boys,
shredded,
I hate you.
Shredded newspaper to play around in. I was done with him as soon as he said, yeah, my buddy at SNL is going to get me a job.
Oh, my God. So upset. Yeah.
We all have a buddy at SNL. Literally, everyone in this room has a buddy at SNL. And we're nowhere.
I've got two.
Yeah. You've got
Brag.
Two.
And like... Guess what,
not
motherfucker?
Happening.
They're not getting you a job.
Yeah.
I mean, that at least that was that sort of posturing. You're just like, yep, that man exists.
It was such a good character portrait, though, where it's just like, here is me floating through life. Yeah, it's gonna happen. Or if that doesn't happen, then you know this other thing that I'm doing.
So
is
many different
happen.
Takes on the Brooklyn douchebag.
Well, that's the thing. This movie does a really good job at showcasing mostly unlikable people. Because, well, maybe this is the time to get into, like, Francis as a manic pixie dream girl type.
But she, because she is a more realistic, less exaggerated version of this trope. Because I actually, I mean, she has those tendencies, but I feel like I know people basically just like her. So it didn't feel like she was like this caricature.
Yeah, what sucks is it suffers because I think it did a pretty good job of just creating a sort of slightly eccentric character, but that is living under this looming shadow of this broad, shitty archetype that we've lived with for so long. Uh-huh. I did do a bit of homework. I wrote something down.
Please.
Which I think this is like some weird Noah Baumbach, I don't know whose idea it is, like sort of Easter egg as to like, this is the key to the movie, sort of.
Mm-hmm. Please and then the go off, queen.
Okay, the opening montage where it's sort of like the friendship montage.
Yeah.
They're kind of, you know, hanging out, they're playing in the park, they're talking. And I think this is on purpose. There's a lot of moments where it just shows them talking, but the dialogue is unintelligible.
Right.
And then there's one moment where they're sitting on the couch and Frances like looks up from her book. She goes, oh, this is interesting. Listen to this. And this is the quote she reads from the book that she's reading, which I don't know if it was made up for the movie or it's actually from something. But she says, to praise a work of literature by calling it sincere is now at best a way of saying that although it may be given no aesthetic or intellectual admiration, and then it like cuts off into the next shot. So I'm kind of like, oof. It's a weird thing to bring up with a lot of qualifiers about like although, or that sincerity is now an excuse for, basically I think it's saying that like to say that sincerity is a compliment is to just sort of you know, avoid the question of like intellectual or aesthetic merit. Mm-hmm. So to say something say something has artistic merit by dint of just being sincere is basically to just say it's not good any other way.
Right. It's like if you're describing a person who is like very boring, you say, oh, but they're really nice.
They're really down to earth. Like, yeah.
But she also, like, it also cuts off the quote. It's implied that there's a whole other clause to that sentence where this author, who may be real or someone they invented for this shot, like, is going to explain or finish that thought. Or I'm just like, these guys, they're tricky. I mean,
I wonder if that's in response to, like, maybe one of Noah Baumbach's previous movies having been called sincere, and he's like, well, here's what I think about I don't know.
I've got to rewatch Squid and the Whale. I really
hated that movie.
I saw it when I was like 15, and I feel like that might be why I liked it. I don't know. Yeah. I remember that someone masturbates in a library in that movie, and that's legitimately all I remember. And then it's about divorce.
You're like, I'm 15, that's the coolest thing
ever. I'm like, they masturbated on screen, and it's about divorce. I masturbate.
Sign me up.
My parents are divorced. I'm not good for me. I had the IFC channel, not to brag.
Wow, a lot of bragging in this episode.
That's quirky as hell. Subscribing to IFC.
Listen, honestly, canonically, if you had the IFC channel when you were in middle school, high school, you will end up dating a Brooklyn douchebag someday. Well, it's unfortunately one of the sad facts of life. I wash my hands of them.
Yes.
Moving right along. I think that Frances, another thing that I picked up on a second watch was that I feel like she's kind of, in some ways, she's kind of supposed to be annoying. Like there's that whole dinner scene that at the time, when I first saw it, I was like, oh, this is like Manic Pixie Dream Girl, boring, dumb. But if she were a true Manic Pixie Dream Girl, people would be very charmed and really like her.
Yes.
Or they would be like, or they would be painted as like broad, like asshole, so that you sympathize with the character.
But you're like on the side of the people who have to endure whatever weird,
they're just
being
like
quirky stuff.
Yeah, they're like nice people trying not to let this girl like ruin their dinner party.
And then there's another scene where I think it's Rachel, her dance friend who she stays with, she's like, I guess, trying to find best friend because Sophie is effectively
another
rid of
thing
her.
That happens. Yeah.
Right. And then so she's like, okay, you're my new best friend, Rachel. Let's play fight. And Rachel's like,
oh,
what?
God.
And then she keeps like kind of trying to push her and do this like play fight thing that she and Sophie used to do that we saw. But like Rachel is not into it at all. She's just like, dude, what the hell? Because she like pushes her out of frame and stuff.
You know, it's so awkward. And it's like, oh, you're just hitting a woman.
Right.
Yes. And she doesn't
You are striking another grown adult.
And like Rachel's being like, I don't want to do this. Please stop. And then she's just like very annoyingly continuing to do it. So yeah,
it's just like, Frances, go to Al-Anon. Come on.
Go to Uniqlo, at least. I don't know. Quit wearing leggings under dresses.
If you're not going to go to Al-Anon and recover from codependency, at least go to Uniqlo.
I'll just say it. Go to Lalabo.
What is that? Become an adult. Yeah, I don't know what that is.
You don't know the cult of Lalabo?
No. It's just like Christina shows me everything. She brought me to Muji for the first time.
Oh, I don't know what that is either.
All I know is that, like, if you're a woman and you live in Brooklyn and you have any money whatsoever, actually, even if you don't have money, you, like, are supposed to wear a scent from Lalabo. It's just like fancy perfume. Oh. Specifically, if you walk through, like, Bushwick or Ridgewood, you're just gonna get this general vibe. But the air is just thick with the waft of something that you can't quite put your finger on.
I see.
And it's Santal 33.
Oh.
There's trends in perfume. Yeah.
Huh. And it only means so much coming from a flock of women who live in Los Angeles, but I am very glad I don't live there.
Hey, I read The Cut.
There. Listen, I read The Cut until I ran out of 5 free articles. Then I hard stop.
You are not getting $5 a month.
No, ma'am. Yeah, I don't know. I think that it is like what I first interpreted to be a manic pixie dream girl, I think is actually more interesting, which is a woman who seems to be like kind of aping manic pixie dream girls and it being annoying to see in the real world, which is kind of cool.
Yeah,
because I feel like a lot of young women, I mean, and I can't speak to it right now, but it's like, I definitely had friends in like high school and college who were going for that it did not, you know,
they saw like Garden State and they're like, oh, what if I'm like that?
They're like, what if I just made no sense? And like, you see people have to course correct and have to like kind of like Frances does. She has to grow up.
Yeah.
I think that's a big part of like anyone's artistic awakening is realizing that you can't just act like an artist or be eccentric as a way of, you know, like masking your
right.
Can we talk about the?
You have to earn it, okay?
And of course, there's like of the. I feel like a lot of tropes are commented on in this movie in a way that I think is like really cool and interesting. Like it seems like in retrospect, I feel like the manic pixie dream girl trope is pretty heavily commented on in this movie in a way that I thought was generally pretty effective. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I'm just exhausted by, and it's will be done forever, is just like, New York is a character. And it was my understanding based on some bare bones research that the only scene I remembered from this movie was Greta Gerwig dancing in the crosswalk to Modern Love, which I guess is paying homage to a different movie.
Every time I go into a crosswalk in New York, I end up punching a car. That's not what happens to me.
Why don't we see that? But yeah, so the whole like I feel like the whole this movie would have been cool to see like New York, the whole New York as a character trope like commented on more thoroughly, but it didn't really.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know.
New York is one character in movies
all the time.
We were talking about the like. Because I was watching this with my boyfriend and we were trying to think of like, is there an LA equivalent to this movie? Just like a low key. I mean, there's so many movies set in and about LA with like LA as a character, but they're fucking crazy. Mm-hmm. And I think like the best ones that are about LA, like Mulholland Drive and Repo Man. I'm like, yeah, they got it. But where's the one that's just like, maybe it would be too bad. Like, yeah, white kids lolling around talking about their dreams.
I feel like...
And like, not in a way that's making fun of people who want to be actors. Like, I don't know.
I mean, I don't know if this is a good example, but like, Ingrid Goes West? Is that sort of...
I think the commentary was a little ham-fisted.
I feel like there's a few...
Visually, they got the lifestyle pretty good, you know?
I don't know. Christina, is there not a documentary?
Oh, there's there's a really good 3-hour video essay by this filmmaker, Tom Anderson, called Los Angeles Plays Itself. And it's a really beautiful commentary about how Los Angeles is depicted in movies, kind of writ large. LA is a character, but also LA disguised as other cities, which is a big part of making movies here. But it's amazing because the whole movie, it's 3 hours, and it's completely cut from other movies with Tom Anderson just sort of narrating and analyzing over it.
Mm-hmm. That's really cool.
And we don't need that movie about New York, so
No, God, I feel like it's made itself over and over. Well, we'll tweet out a link to that.
Yeah.
That sounds, yeah, I'm excited to
watch. Isn't it just like Philip, that's the equivalent would be like a Philip Roth novel. I don't know.
Speaking of cities that play themselves in movies constantly ad nauseum, Greta Gerwig goes to Paris in this movie.
Yeah.
I feel like it's really New York and Paris are the cities that do it to the point where you're like, I just never need to see this again in my entire life. Or at least the kind that is presented. But I feel like in this movie, Paris as a character is commented on, where this was one of the
parts. Oh, yeah.
Like this, yeah, we were talking about, like, this was a scene that I think I was, I don't really remember, but I definitely didn't understand the point of her going to Paris by herself and being miserable. And I think my first read of it when I was much younger was like, oh, like, what a whiner. She's in Paris. Like, this is so cool. And then I like the way that it's framed in the movie now, though, where it's clear that she can't afford to be doing this. Mm-hmm. It seems to be a knee-jerk reaction to her feeling insecure about her place in life. She's just going into debt kind of for no reason to seem like she's doing better than she is.
Well, it seems like I thought that it was even smart in that, like, she's going because she's seen too many movies where people find themselves in Paris.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
And she does this immediately after she hears from someone else that Sophie is moving abroad to Tokyo.
Right.
So she's like, well, I can go somewhere else too, is what it feels like she's doing.
And the lesson is, wherever you go, you're still there.
You're still fucking depressed,
and then,
my friend.
So she sleeps through almost the entire time that she's there because she, like, stays up all night because she's, like, probably has, like, whatever. She's on a different time zone. She stays up way too late, doesn't do anything. She's just, like, hanging out in the apartment. And then she sleeps till, like, 4 p.m. the next day and, like, has wasted pretty much the whole day. And then she's calling her friend who's there, can't get a hold of her. So, like, essentially does nothing
gets
with her
a hold
time
of her at the last minute
when she's
late.
Already on her way back to New York.
It's
like,
I think the
worst part, and I think this speaks to her codependent behavior, the only reason why her trip is so short, because she's blowing all her money on the plane ticket, she has a free place to stay, is she's like, I have to go now, but I have to be back Monday at 3 p.m. to have this important meeting with my boss. And she doesn't even have the wherewithal to reschedule it ahead of time, and even when she gets there, her boss is like, I almost canceled it this morning because I had gas or whatever.
I've done that. I've rushed back from somewhere to be disappointed and dismissed, like, it just,
or just to be at a thing that you felt was more important than the other person did, that, like, it could have been changed. Oh, it's so embarrassing. And, like, wait, you flew back from Paris to be at this meeting?
It all has to do with the fact that her character has not fully grown up, even though she's 27. She's still rather immature. She's not very self-aware. She needs to have a second coming of age, as, you know, many people are.
If she were 22, it would be adorable.
right. But for
maybe.
Because she's a handful of years older, it starts to look, I don't know. I mean, but that was what I really, like, something I really liked about the movie was, like,
I mean,
having to learn how to hedge your expectations.
We talk that, and I mean, we talk about this here and there, but representation of female mediocrity.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm. We will not achieve equality until
we see
mediocre women can also
are as interesting as mediocre men.
Exactly.
Right. Totally. Which is like most of these Brooklyn movies, as mediocre men feeling bad for themselves. So
I'm going to start the greatest denim company in New York.
Is that a movie?
I don't know. Oh, yes, there is. There was one called Making It in America, and it was about two. It was a show. I think it was on HBO, about two guys trying to start a denim company.
Oh, right.
I feel sick.
A gritty, you know, crime-ridden denim company.
A really groundbreaking.
They do the distressing by just firing AK-47s at it. Like, how crazy would it be to pitch a show about, like, a woman trying to start an Etsy store in Brooklyn?
I mean,
but have it not be a joke.
Right.
This was a very serious, like,
have you seen the show Girl Boss? That's what that is.
Oh, well, it was bad. It was canceled after one season.
But it was like, that was, I mean, that movie was, that, not I mean, movie, that show was dog shit, but it was female media.
But it was dog shit just because everyone did a bad job on it. The idea itself is not horrible.
No. Right. Like, I liked seeing, and I feel like, again, it's like, representing women in movies should not be this hard, but it is. Where I feel like we have sort of had in recent years an influx of hashtag inspirational Mary Sue type characters who we need to see succeed at the end of the movie, because that is the first step of representation, is seeing someone in the most perfect light possible,
right,
to justify their existence at all.
Yeah.
Right. So and then
we
like,
can trickle down to more nuanced representations.
Right. Mm-hmm. And in this way it's like, it does still feel like it's like, well, we can only see it when it's like a pretty like Western beauty standards, middle class white lady.
Right.
But you still see like a more nuanced female character than you normally would. You are allowed to see her fail and like struggle with that and need to like, it's cool. I don't know.
I do like, I think about this a lot. And I'm like, the wider question is like, and I think it just gets to the heart of like the idea of the individual in a Western social manager, and is that like, why do I have to see myself reflected in media?
Yeah, this
and
really,
that is,
yeah.
But that is so deep. I don't think we'll ever get to the point where we can actually interrogate that, because it is important. But and now we're at the point where you kind of have to just cherry pick it one at a time. Like, okay, Frances Ha. Okay, we're gonna have a character that's like kind of doesn't succeed, and this is about compromise. But she has to be like blonde and cute. That's like,
yeah.
If she's maybe a person of color, well then, well, we gotta like up it here, you know what I mean? And
sure.
It feels like, I don't know if we're, obviously we're not there.
No,
because
not
even
yet.
When it happens, it feels like a balancing act of like, I have to check these boxes and uncheck these to make this cultural product palatable and marketable.
I mean, we kind of totally. Talked about that on the Booksmart episode, where they like, yeah. They clearly had like a quote woke list where it's like, all right, we want to talk about these things as it pertains to, you know, women and feminism and things like that. But then they like erased women of color from the whole movie.
Yeah.
So it's like, if, you know, it's.
And that's the question of like ethics versus artistic merits. It's like, okay, well, if you're going to make, there's a reason why we make fun of after school specials, because they're morality plays. Like, they are moral statements disguised as entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a fine line between creating, like, equitable representation versus, like, well, I'm just checking the, like, the morality boxes at the expense of, you know. But maybe that's bullshit, too, because if the whole history of the medium is predicated on exclusion, then the question of good or bad does become moral as well.
You sound like such a scholar.
I wrote this down. I was
She's
having a text. I think this is true. I was having a text conversation with my boyfriend. We were arguing about like craft and ethics.
Your boyfriend, get out.
Yeah, I'm sorry. No boys allowed.
Sorry, my hetero life partner, supplied to me by Lord Bezos.
No, what were you saying?
I was just getting so mad. I mean, and he. I don't know how this started, but he was like trying to buy a rug from Afghanistan. And then we got into this whole argument about ethics in art. And I just tried to like end it by saying like the ethics of art is just a Mobius strip of necessary and good on one side and then the immoral on the other side. And history just kind of paints them both different colors until they bump into each other. And he was like, dude, I saw the Avengers with you. We both know that's how Robert Downey Jr. invents time travel. I mean, these things are... It's also, historically determined. So who knows, like, 20 years from now, this movie or Booksmart are going to seem, like, so pat and cloying.
Well, that's,
right. I mean, when we're still doing the podcast
in
20 years from now.
You know, huddled over a garbage can fire.
Right.
Going, but her emails.
Knee deep in water.
We're going to be needing storing, put my sugar crystals are actually just parts of the barrier reef, and they melt in my coffee.
We'll have a little generator and a floaty.
And
if you're wearing floaties.
It's going to be Isaac on a bicycle. That's how we run the generator.
And that's our feminism at this point, that men are electricity now. I think it's interesting that you describing like almost as a scale.
Kind of.
More of like, well, if this is true, then this needs to, because it does seem like female representation in general, like it is like, if these things are flawed, then these things need to be, quote unquote, not flawed. And like, I mean, could you make a movie like Frances Ha with a non-white character at this time? I don't know that that would have experienced success in the same way that this movie did, or that it would have been accepted in the same way this movie did. And that's worth discussing. And I think that that is like something that is still present in, as much as I like enjoyed it and I thought it was a fun romp of a movie, like Booksmart to me felt like to an extent like kind of a checklisty kind of movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the good thing about that means that at least hitting some points like that is now marketable and is now like something that people will give you money to make. If you're right. a very famous white lady already.
Yes.
But, you know, it's like at least the idea of movies that feature women that are flawed to an extent as marketable is really cool and indicates progress. And I don't know. I feel like this movie, like Frances Ha is almost like a little bit of an outlier. I mean, it also helps that it was really cheap to make. It's $3 million budget.
Oh, yes.
For this movie. So super, super cheap.
I'll Venmo it. You know.
No one in this movie was really famous yet. Mm-hmm. I feel like Noah Baumbach is most likely the reason that this got made because he had had a few successes already.
Yeah, and it was like, I think this is her first movie that she co-wrote. That's assuming a lot. Did she write any of these mumblecore? Also, I will say she's a very good actress because I think this movie, I just felt like, oh my gosh, she's just being sort of awkwardly herself. But then I saw 20th Century Women. I'm like, oh, Greta Gerwig, she's a real actress because she plays a much more, also a weird artist, but more articulate kind of together. I'm like, oh, a character that I don't conflate with Greta Gerwig. So
yeah.
I don't know if she's written.
Her first credited writing thing is like, because she made a bunch of Joe Swanberg movies. So for those
Joe Whatberg?
Joe Swanberg was like Mr. Mumblecore. He lived in Chicago. He made that shitty Netflix show Easy. Sorry if you liked it. I thought it was shitty, but whatever. He made a bunch of these early Mumblecore movies. Mm-hmm. So her first credited writing credit was on a 2007 movie called Hannah Takes the Stairs. Haven't seen
it. Oh, yeah.
But that was
canon first Mumblecore.
And then she directed her first movie. She directed a Mumblecore movie in 2008 that she wrote as well. But this is, I mean.
Oh, was Lady Bird not her first direct? I thought that was her directorial debut, but.
Nice. I'm going to go ahead and say I think Noah and Greta greater than the sum of their parts.
Hmm. Ooh, I agree. I mean,
because I like this better than Lady Bird, and I definitely liked it better than anything Noah Baumbach has done.
Yeah. I definitely like this is my favorite. I mean, I'm pretty sure I've only seen two or three. He made that shitty movie with Ben Stiller, right? Greenberg?
Yeah.
Is that right? Okay. I mix up Noah Baumbach and Joe Swanberg all the time because I just really don't care about
either. Well, one makes more money.
That's true. That's true. And for a man, we got to hand it to them. Greta Gerwig's directorial debut was a mumblecore flop with Joe Swanberg, but it was made for $15,000.
Oh, sure.
So, you know, like I think Lady Bird was her, like,
Her big one.
It's credited as her solo directorial debut. She co-directed in 2008.
Okay, got it.
Either way, this was Greta Gerwig's big break, uh-huh. I think, is like it's viewed as. And I think that is great and a very slight tip of the hat to Noah Baumbach for really featuring her and giving her the credit she deserved, because it seems like if this movie was just written by Noah Baumbach, it wouldn't have had the focus on the female friendship. It wouldn't have had the focus on her, and it wouldn't have reflected her experience as well as it does.
Yeah. No, it's funny. I remember when it came out, reading an interview with Noah Baumbach, which, if I remember correctly, it's funny that there was a magazine piece just about Noah Baumbach for the release of this movie.
Of course.
Naturally. Yeah. But he did say that, yeah, it was kind of, he had to coax her into writing it because at that time in her life, I think she was probably like 27 or maybe a little later, almost mm-hmm. 30. Mm-hmm. And she was sort of venting about these frustrations in her own career. And he was just like, that's fascinating. Write it down. But so,
which is
the
like,
point is that like you need a man to point out to you what's interesting about you and what's worthy about you artistically in order to put it out into the world.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's almost a reflection of the, okay, I'm going to give an example from a friend that who may or may not have been on this podcast previously, but I don't know if she wants me to put her on blast that way. But an example of like how I think women very often are trained to underestimate themselves mm-hmm. For things that men will just be like, oh, of course I can do this.
Yes.
And how at times having a male ally to tell you, you know, no, you are ready to do this is important. And I think like that
oh,
is
yeah.
a cool, like my dear friend mm-hmm. was considering running for office inside of like this social group that she'd been a part of for almost 2 years, but then was repeatedly saying like, I don't know if I'm ready. I don't know if like people take me seriously enough. I don't know if I've proven myself in this group quite enough. And then when they were announcing, okay, who's going to run for this position? Three guys who had been there less than a month were like, I think I'm ready. And so then that was what convinced her of like, no, I've fucking been ready for this. All these people who just got here think that they're ready. And so, I mean,
for better or worse, that's a real thing and that's important. Like,
slight props to Noah Baumbach for, you know, saying what deservedly needed to be said because she was ready.
Yeah.
So
I'm gonna go out into the street and ask all the dudes if I'm ready.
Only they will be able to tell you.
Well, all that to say, if you are a man with any power or influence that is in a position to, you know,
encourage,
lift
up, produce.
Put the spotlight on someone who deserves it that hasn't had it yet.
Go down on without expecting anything in return.
Yes. Don't always choose the person who has exactly your experience or nothing will ever happen.
Yeah.
Ding.
One little just quick thing I wanted to point out is in the beginning when Francis and Sophie are still getting along splendidly. Mm-hmm. They're talking about their futures and the things that they want. And they're like, yeah, we'll do this. And I think this is when it's at a point in the movie where they're getting along and they're close. They say, we'll have lovers and no children. And I just appreciate visibility for women who don't want to have kids.
Yeah.
As a woman who does not want to have children, it's always refreshing to see that represented on screen.
Yeah.
So the end.
I like it. I like it all. Is there anything else that anyone wanted to hit on before we...
I've been to Paris.
Christina, how could you have gone this far into this episode without announcing
it? So I just wanted to say that as someone who kind of found herself in Paris at one point, in 2013, actually, a year after this movie came out.
I mean, it couldn't have happened before.
But it was the kind of thing where I got off the plane and I remember thinking, oh my God, like it actually does look, Paris just looks like Paris. It looks like exactly like every postcard and movie and thing you've seen. And there's something deeply sad about that. Mm. And I haven't recovered. I have to go back every month.
Absolutely, yes. Well, luckily you have that free place to stay.
Yes. And it's like, I like to blurt that out at dinner parties. I've been to Paris.
Honestly, if we're out and more than 2 seconds passes, she says it. Any lull of silence in the car?
I've been to Paris. Do you have an iPhone charger I can use?
May I just say?
You can go to casinos and do that. I've been to Paris.
Big money. I've been to Paris.
If you lose on a slot machine, I've been to Paris.
Knock the whole thing over.
How is it possible?
May I just say that I've been to Paris.
Okay. No, there can only be one. Have we learned nothing from female protagonists?
Let's fight each other. Regretfully, I have.
I went in 2010, so I went there first.
Okay, well, clearly, someone who does things the first time is the only time that it matters. So, okay, I concede.
Thank you so much.
Who won the podcast today? Is there a real question?
I think that was all I had to say about the film.
I guess this was one of the few examples in the history of this podcast that I have gone back and rewatched a movie and looked on it fonder than I did when I first watched it.
Oh, very quick. I did want to say, I had a fabulous time and it was really great discussing the movie. It was pretty low on my list. Yes, for five options, and this was like probably fifth, and I was like, really?
We already did Josie and the Pussycat.
Oh, really? I thought I looked at the thing.
It's okay. Well, you done fucked up. You done.
And we have to end on shaming our guests. We have to do it. Simply had to.
Save me, Lord Bezos.
She just got beamed up. She's gone.
See ya.
She's in his ship now. I'm glad we reviewed this, though. And I think I'm glad we did it. To those who requested it, I hope you enjoyed it. But ladies, does it pass the Bechdel test?
Oh, I don't think. No, yes, no, it does.
It's super dumb. I think so.
There's some really quirky grading passes of the Bechdel test, which is a new subsection of the test. Is it a quirky pass? But there's a lot of...
Yeah.
But yeah, it's like, you know, Sophie and Francis are talking. Rachel and Francis are talking.
It passes in like the first 10 seconds.
Yes.
Yeah, and continues to do so.
She's like, I wouldn't eat a dog. And it's like, yeah, you would.
Oh, the last thing I did want to say is I liked representation of a failed attempt at being a guy's gal for a couple of months.
Yeah,
I have also tried to be a guy's gal for a span of months. It never ends well, and I it was like,
Jeez, Lord Bezos, make me not like other girls.
Yeah, exactly. It is nice to see a girl like, I'm not like the other girls, and see it be like, oh, it would actually be really chill if I could hang out with my friend who's a girl again.
Yeah.
Much, much better. Mm-hmm. It does pass the Bechdel test.
It sure does.
And yeah. Shall we just...
give it a little rating?
Give it a little rating?
Sure.
How many stars? What's the out of what's
so,
the
oh, we'll nipple tell you. Scale? Yeah. So ooh, we've yeah. got a nipple scale. Zero mm-hmm. to five nipples based on its representation and treatment of women. I'd say I'm between like a 3 and a 3.5 on this, where cool. largely the movie is about a female friendship, which, as we've said before and we'll say again, is not the focus of most movies. So it's because most movies, the focus is either a hetero relationship between a man and a woman, or it is two boys. The boys are there and they're having a friendship.
Yeah.
So nice to see female friendship celebrated, and as we've discussed, in a way that is not like a perfect Mary Sue kind of thing, where it's just like, oh, look how awesome these women are, and they're just so, they get along so well, because that is not representative of real life. So we get to see these two different characters grow apart, come back together again, all this stuff, because of their, you know, individual nuances and issues that they have and are, you know, trying to grow from and move through and all that stuff. So nice to see fairly well-rounded characters
yeah.
and in their friendship, and that be the focus of the movie. You know, female mediocrity is something that we do appreciate, and
not even
Frances.
Frances, I don't know. I'm like she's not mediocre. She's just had to accept that she's not good at everything and had to find out what she was good at and
sure.
accept it.
Yes.
Yeah. I thought that was cool.
Mm-hmm. And again, realistic.
Yes, yes.
So, yes.
I'm addicted to accepting my limitations. Just kidding.
Very refreshing to yes. see on screen. Yeah, but then, you know, there's some issues in that it's, you know, oh boy, is it a white movie? They don't have any friends who are people of color, and I don't think that I remember seeing.
Not to open a can of worms, but like, is that, that's kind of like a moral fear, but is it an artistic failure? Because these kind of people probably don't have friends of color, right?
Yeah, I just feel like they're always in a position
just
to do
a
it.
A little boring, too.
It's just boring, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, just right, would like a Brooklyn trust fund bro have like a black friend? I don't know. Maybe not, but why are we making movies about people like that then?
I just, any all-white New York movie, I'm just like, you were in a creative position to make this not the case.
Right, yes. So
I feel like the most diverse scene we saw was when she's teaching the ballet class. Yeah. Her ballet class, the little girls, it was a very diverse group of yeah. little ballerinas.
Aw, cute.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'll settle on a 3.5, and I'll give one to Greta. I'll give one to the actor who plays Sophie. I'll give one to our super producer, Sophie.
Yay!
And I'll give my final half nipple to the hairless cat that maybe the boyfriend ended up getting. Maybe not. We don't know.
I'm going between 3.5 feels right, but I'm tempted to go for a 4. I don't know. I guess I'll for whoever's making the Wikipedia page, you put down 3.5 or 4. Up to you.
Wow,
I give you the editorial power.
That is some power.
Because I do agree that I think, you know, whenever there is a director, writer, you're in a position to be inclusive. And when you make the choice not to, that choice should be justified in a way that's more than like, well, it wouldn't, you know, like it just kind of like a wincy kind of response to it doesn't really, it just seems like it's kind of like, I don't know. It doesn't work for me, but
sure.
I got this movie wrong the first time, and I have grown to really appreciate it. There were parts of this movie that were genuinely difficult for me to watch because I saw elements of myself or my own friends, I think that it is a pretty accurate depiction of a, like, I hesitate to put the word millennial into this podcast at all, but, or out into the world further, but like, but someone who has been, you know, grew up being told they could do anything, then encounter the financial and personal obstacles that make it clear that that is kind of an empty promise, and navigating their way and finding their place. It is something that is very hashtag relatable to a lot of women and also people. I think that this is like that men can also take a lot away from this movie, and it's not specifically a women's movie, which is really cool. And yeah. I think Greta Gerwig does a great job. It's like mumblecore-ish in a way that isn't like distracting to me. And I don't know. I think it was like just the right amount of pathetic in a way that made me uncomfortable for hours afterwards.
All right.
Because everyone is a little bit pathetic, and seeing it on screen is not a comfortable experience, but a poignant one. So I'll go with a 3.5 or a 4, and you know, let history decide which I chose. I'll give one to Frances Ha. I'll give one to Sophie. I'll give one to the lady that Greta Gerwig works for, who's like, I don't even remember my work. I don't even remember it's my work after it happens.
Baldest woman in charge.
The baldest woman in charge.
Yeah.
And then I'll give half a nipple to the city of New York.
Oh,
or
my gosh.
A half a nipple or a full nipple, depending on who.
Okay.
Christina.
All right. Quattro nipples. One nipple for Mickey Sumner. One nipple for Benji's friends at SNL. One nipple for taking the whole crew to Paris to film a 3-minute scene. Half nipple for saying the name of the movie in the movie all the way at the very end. Uh-huh. And you're like, wow, yeah, I get it.
That's what it meant.
And obligatory half nipple tithing to my Lord and Savior, Jeff Bezos.
Oh, yes. I love it.
Okay.
Christina, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Where can we find
you? I'm clapping for myself.
Yes. I'll clap for you too.
We genuinely did clap when Frances Ha came on the
screen. We're like, yes, it all makes sense.
It's all coming together.
Oh, it's like when they say the Winter Soldier. You're like, whoa! Like, it's just crazy.
You want to know where you can find me on the...
Please, where are you?
Follow me on Instagram. I put everything there. Links to usually... If I write something or I'm doing shows, I put it all there. I'm bad at updating my website, but there's my comedy videos and writing there, which is linked from Instagram anyway. So it's at... We use the at symbol. Xtina _ Catherine with a C. Because Christina Catherine doesn't fit in the username box.
I see.
But that's good stuff. You should follow me there.
Please follow. You can find us on all the stuff. We're at Facebook, on the Twitter, on the Instagram, at BechtelCast. You can find our Patreon, aka Matreon, patreon.com/BechtelCast. $5 a month will get you 2 extra episodes and access to the full back catalog.
What a darn good special. You can also check out our merch store at tpublic.com/TheBechtelCast. Cast. Ooh. Oh my goodness.
The Bechtel class. Icona Bechtel class. You know? Do you see where I was going?
I see. The Icona class?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think so.
Is it a lurch store for lady merch?
Oh, go on.
Am I doing it right?
Yes. This is feminism. Yeah. Thank you for listening as always. And we will see you next week.
See you next week.
Bye-bye.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart for a year, and what a year it has been. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Make Woke AF Daily your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
how this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like $1 million.
...scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes...
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old rich man, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.